Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Robert Borisage of the Campaign for America's Future, who explains how President Obama's budget moves the nation in a more progressive direction with a look at the important political battles that lie ahead. Dr. Oliver Fine, president of Physicians for a National Health Program, who explains why he believes single-payer government health insurance is the best answer to fixing America's broken healthcare system. And Winona Howder, executive director of Food and Water Watch, who talks about an international protest against water privatization, which will be held at the corporate-sponsored World Water Forum in Turkey in mid-March. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
For 3 years, India and Pakistan engaged in secret talks to settle the status of the disputed territory of Kashmir, where violence has killed over 50,000 people since 1989. According to the New Yorker magazine, the initiative stalled in 2007 as the two presidents, India's Manmohan Singh and Pakistan's Pervez Musharraf, were about to go public on the agreement and try to sell it to their two nations. The deal called for creating an autonomous region with open borders for trade from both India and Pakistan. Tension between India and Pakistan hit a low point when Pakistan-based militants led a terror attack on Mumbai last fall after Musharraf had resigned from office and the opposition had won a sweeping victory in elections after the assassination of Benazir Bhutto. With Western pressure, India-Pakistan cooperation has improved since the Mumbai attack. According to the New Yorker investigation, the framework of the Kashmir deal still has strong support among the military elite in Pakistan and India. But popular support remains in doubt, as Indian President Singh faces a tough re-election battle in April, and Pakistan President Asif Zardari has not staked out a position on the Kashmir deal. The International Criminal Court has issued an arrest warrant for Sudan President Omar al-Bashir for war crimes and crimes against humanity for his complicity in Darfur atrocities. At the same time, the three-judge panel who issued the order on March 4th dropped the genocide charge against Bashir. Since 2003, over 300,000 have been killed in violence in Darfur, the western district of Sudan, where more than 2.7 million people have been forced out of their homes. In Khartoum, Bashir has refused to recognize the authority of the International Criminal Court. After the arrest warrant was issued, Sudan expelled 13 Western-based humanitarian organizations, such as Oxfam and Doctors Without Borders, that provide food, water, and medical care to a million people in Darfur. Bashir alleged the relief groups had provided information to the ICC investigation. For the moment, Bashir has the backing of the African Union, the Arab League, and China, major investors in Sudan's growing oil industry. China blocked the United Nations Security Council resolution condemning Sudan for expelling the humanitarian groups. Over the long term, human rights groups feel the arrest warrant will weaken Bashir's standing in Sudan and lead to bigger splits in his ruling National Congress Party. Then, outside backers like China or the Arab League would likely distance themselves from Bashir, leading to Bashir's eventual arrest. Corporate America has raised an estimated $100 million and created front groups to defeat the labor-backed Employee Free Choice Act, legislation that would allow workers to use a card check system to win union recognition. In last fall's election, Walmart and Home Depot urged workers to vote against Democratic candidates because they would support a bill mandating union representation if a majority of workers signed union authorization cards. The labor bill is also firmly opposed by the Chamber of Commerce, the National Right to Work Committee, and conservative political guru Grover Norquist. According to the news magazine In These Times, the Employee Free Choice Act is popular with the public, gaining 73% support in a recent poll. In 2003, unions started pushing for the card check bill to counter growing management intimidation campaigns during union elections run by the National Labor Relations Board. Despite the strong Democratic majority in Congress, prospects for passage of the card check bill, which passed the House of Representatives in 2007, remain uncertain. Moderate Democrats from southern, non-union states are wavering on the bill, and Democrats will need 60 votes to pass the legislation in the Senate. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Ruben Abreu.
In unveiling his first proposed budget for fiscal year 2010, President Barack Obama has staked out new priorities for the nation, making a clean break with his predecessor's trickle-down, government-is-the-enemy philosophy. In justifying its change in direction, the White House attached a narrative to the budget titled Growing Imbalance, Accumulating Wealth and Closing Doors to the Middle Class, which presented a set of statistics illustrating growing wealth inequality and making the case that a change in the tax code was necessary to redress the imbalance that for 8 years has harmed America's middle class. The $3.6 trillion budget proposes an increase in taxes on couples earning more than $250,000 a year by raising the top two marginal income tax rates to 39.6% and 36%, limiting itemized tax deductions and increasing taxes on capital gains to 20% from the current 15%. Taxes on Wall Street financiers would also be raised. On the spending side, Obama wants to make major investments in energy independence, the environment, education, and health care reform. The president's budget will undoubtedly be challenged by Republicans, many of whom have a fierce loyalty to policies favoring corporations and the wealthy, an ideology championed by Ronald Reagan. But conservative congressional Democrats may be the most formidable obstacle in winning passage of Mr. Obama's key priorities. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Robert Borisage, co-director of Campaign for America's Future, who explains how Obama's budget moves the nation in a more progressive direction and the important political battles that lie ahead.
Well, this is a stunning budget. This is certainly the most ambitious budget of any president since Reagan rolled back the Great Society, or on the liberal side, since Johnson passed the Great Society in the 1960s. It makes a dramatic change in the philosophy of the last 30 years, and it does so explicitly in the introductory letter by the president to this budget document. It's a much harsher and clearer document or statement than he made in his State of the Union address, where he really does say it is time to end the philosophy and the policies of the last years, which have featured this trickle-down philosophy, and instead it's time to invest in America and build it from the bottom up. And the budget does that. It makes dramatic investments in energy, in education, in health care to start to make the investments we need towards going forward. And then it pays for it by taking on really entrenched interests, cutting the obscene incentives that go to insurance companies to compete with Medicare, reducing prescription drug prices, cutting subsidies to agribusiness, letting the top end Bush tax cuts expire, keeping the estate tax at a sensible level rather than letting it disappear next year, taxing the income of equity fund managers as income as opposed to as investment, cutting subsidies to oil companies, eliminating banks from the student loan program. I can go on. It's just a stunning list of taking on the most really obscene subsidies that have been built in by corporate lobbies into the budget, and using that money to pay for basic investments in education and in energy and in healthcare.
How do you think the debate is going so far on this budget, and what are its chances of passage? There are undoubtedly going to be some changes, maybe some small ones, maybe some big ones, but you think overall this thing is going to pass muster in Congress?
Well, the first hurdle is to get the budget resolution passed, and that'll take place, that vote will take place in early April. That is a vote that it only requires a majority vote. So you really don't need any Republican votes to pass it. What you do need is the votes of conservative Democrats. And they've already started to dissent from this provision or that, argue that they don't want to do the tax cuts on the wealthy, that they'd rather, Max Baucus recently said he'd rather tax health care benefits that workers get than to reduce taxes on the wealthy. So there's going to have to be a real concerted campaign aimed at Democrats, particularly the new Democrats and the conservative Democrats, to get this thing passed as a budget resolution in April. Then the real battle starts with all the committees and the appropriations for each piece of this under the budget caps, and that'll be trench warfare with the interests, the corporate lobbies I mentioned before. And that'll go all the way until October or November, when we will get the mother of all reconciliation bills, which is the only way this thing passes.
You mentioned the likely opposition to some major planks in the budget by Blue Dog Democrats, conservative Democrats around the country. Is there a grassroots organization in place that can effectively challenge and pressure these Blue Dogs to vote for change, to vote for this budget, to change the priorities of the country?
Yeah, I think those pieces are being put together. You know, you have the Obama 2.0, if you will, the 13 million person list that he got from his campaign that's now lodged at the DNC. I think that list will be informed about these issues, and they'll be called upon to call their legislators early to support them. But there's a limit to how much the president directly can go after members of his own party or even the other party without creating permanent enemies. And so it's going to require an independent organization to go after both the Blue Dogs and the Republicans at the end of the day, the appropriations process. And that's being put together as we speak, and I think will be in place pretty soon. I think it's really important for independent groups to have the resources to inform the constituents of senators and congressmen and to challenge them in their own districts in both parties, because the way the lobbies work is they're bipartisan. They fund people with power. They fund the key committee chairs, the key committee minority leaders, and they spread their money around increasingly rather widely. We've already seen press reports about the military lobby and the drug lobby and the health insurance lobby raising literally millions of dollars to gear up for this fight. The corporations are saying they're going to do a $200 million campaign against the Employee Free Choice Act. And they spend that money not just on Republicans, but on Democrats as well. And so it's really important that we have an independent operation that exposes that and the money that these senators and legislators are taking and challenges them in their own districts.
That was Robert Borisaj, co-director of Campaign for America's Future. Contact the campaign at area code 202-955-5665 or visit the group's website at ourfuture.org. On March 5th, more than 100 healthcare experts were invited to the White House by President Obama to consider solutions for repairing the broken U.S. health insurance system. About 40 million Americans are currently uninsured, which actually is a drop of several million since federal coverage was recently extended to low-income children under the S-CHIP bill, which had been vetoed twice by former President Bush. However, several million Americans still remain underinsured. Of all the experts invited, not one was a supporter of single-payer health care, also known as Medicare for All. Labeled by critics as socialized medicine, single-payer has been targeted by health insurance companies who have an enormous financial interest in discouraging support among the American people. However, polls show a majority of Americans do support the concept of government-provided health insurance. After protests over the exclusion of single-payer advocates from the Obama Health Care Summit, the guest list was expanded to include Michigan Representative John Conyers, who has introduced single-payer legislation H.R. 676, which now has almost 100 co-sponsors, and Dr. Oliver Fine, president of Physicians for a National Health Program. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Dr. Fine, a practicing internist at Weill Cornell Medical College in New York City, about support for single-payer among consumers and health providers and its chances of success in this year of economic freefall.
Essentially, what we mean by single-payer is that there is a publicly financed, privately delivered healthcare system. And what publicly financed means is that you really move from the multiple private health insurers that we have now to a single entity that finances healthcare instead of using premiums, probably uses taxes to collect the money, but that just as in Medicare today, which is the way Medicare is set up, taxes pay for it, you have a private delivery system. No one would have to change their doctor or change the hospital that they go to. The way in which we would save money under such a system is, number one, the overhead and profit that goes to private health insurance is approximately 20%. The overhead and profit that goes to Medicare, for instance, there is no profit there, but the overhead is about 3%. So just in terms of insurance companies, there's a major saving. In my office, I have to hire extra personnel to deal with each of the individual private health insurance companies because they each have different rules, different regulations, different paperwork that I have to fill out. And so under a single-payer program, I wouldn't have to do that. I would be able to have less people working for me. And that's true for hospitals as well. We looked at and compared Toronto General with the Mass General. And in Toronto, where you have a single-payer system, they've got three billers in their billing office in the hospital. At the Mass General, over 300 billers.
A number of opinion polls over the last number of years show that Americans actually favor single-payer. Isn't that true?
This is ABC, you know, CBS, Washington Post, New York Times polls. The question is usually asked in the following fashion. Do you prefer the current system or a government-run, like Medicare, taxpayer-financed healthcare system? And responses to that have been between 60 and 68% of Americans in these well-designed polls support that. We think that that sounds a lot like single-payer.
And what about polls of physicians?
The most recent one that has been published was published in the Annals of Internal Medicine in April of 2008. And the question that was asked there is, do you support government legislation to establish national health insurance? Didn't say explicitly single payer. 59% of, again, a well-designed sample of the AMA master file of practicing physicians, 59% said that they favored that.
Earlier in his career, President Obama was more supportive of single payer than he appears to be now. Why do you think he's backed away from it?
Well, I think, number one, he has, you know, so clearly articulated a position of bipartisanship, right? That's what he, in his campaign, has articulated and what he has tried to articulate as president. And I think that he views single payer as, you know, a very partisan issue, and he's right. I mean, that a large number of Republicans have already said not just that single payer shouldn't be considered, but even a limited public option to private health insurance should not be considered.
Oliver Fine, some commentators say that due to the economic meltdown, now is not the time for a major overhaul of health care, while others say it is the perfect time. What do you think are its possibilities now? What do you think are its chances?
There's no question that this is a real moment of opportunity for there to be a new approach to healthcare reform in the United States. When you have, you know, 14,000 people losing jobs every day, and what happens when you lose your job in the United States? You lose your health insurance. With that phenomenon occurring, we're going to see a huge number of people getting uninsured. Clearly, there needs to be more of a public outcry in favor of this.
That was Dr. Oliver Fine, president of Physicians for a National Health Program. For more information, call area code 312-782-6006 or visit the group's website at pnhp.org. As the world's supply of fresh, potable water declines, multinational corporations around the world have moved to acquire and privatize municipal water supplies in the quest for profit. While big water companies like Bechtel, German energy conglomerate RWE, and French-based Vivendi and Suez argue that privately owned water utilities lead to greater economic efficiency and stabilize rates. Critics maintain that water privatization has been a disaster in terms of declining water quality and unaffordable rates, which limits community access. In Cochabamba, Bolivia, skyrocketing rate hikes on water, which followed the privatization of water resources by Bechtel, led to a violent water rebellion in 2000 that forced the government to cancel the contract and turn over management of the water system back to the community. When the corporate-sponsored Fifth World Water Forum is held in Istanbul, Turkey, from March 16th through the 22nd, an international coalition of activists will be present to protest the forum's stance on water privatization and defend access to water as a universal human right. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Winona Howder, executive director of Food and Water Watch, part of the coalition of groups that will be present in Istanbul. Howder talks about the failure of water privatization and the campaign to draft an international treaty that will limit the exploitation of water as a for-profit commodity.
The World Water Forums take place every 3 years. The last one was in Mexico, and the one before that was in Kyoto 6 years ago. And the World Water Forums are convened by big business lobby organizations like the World Water Council and the Global Water Partnership. And they are basically using these very large events, 20,000 to 25,000 people usually converge on these water forums, and they use them as a way to promote the privatization of water, the creation of water markets, and basically trying to figure out how to make a profit out of water.
Maybe you could talk about the coalition of groups that are going to be there to provide a different message as these private for-profit water companies are gathering. What's your message there?
Well, over the past 6 to 8 years, a global water justice movement has been created that's international, and it is responding to this crisis of 1.1 billion people not having access to water, 2.6 billion people not having access to sanitation. And meanwhile, rather than having our governments stand up and do something, giving the power to these private corporations. So this water movement has been able to create momentum to change some of the policies. And one way that this has happened is by going to these water forums and actually at the forums challenging the policies that are being promoted. What will happen this time is that that there will be very diverse programs in two different forums. There are two large Turkish coalitions. One is called the No to Commercialization of Water Platform, and the other is another Water Management is Possible campaign. And these are broad-based coalitions from different regions of Turkey. And the international group that's been helping to put on these alternative forums has been working with the Turkish groups to come up with actual series of events in different locations that will take place during the same time that the World Water Forum is taking place. And there are about 200 activists going from around the world. And many of us are also enrolled to go into the Water Forum, where we will go divide up the different sessions and during the open mic time challenge a lot of the policies that are being promoted. So the World Water Forum is really an illegitimate place to be making decisions about the future of such an important resource as water. We believe that UN is the agency that's in the best position to make these decisions, to hold forums, and to have the negotiations that need to take place around good water management practices. The World Water Forum acts as a ministerial, but it's actually put on by private water companies. And they invite governments to come and have these discussions. And we think that that's a completely inappropriate way to go about this. And one of the exciting things that's taking place for this year's World Water Forum and the alternative events is that Miguel de Escota Brockman, who's the president of the UN General Assembly during this year, has appointed Maud Barlow, who's the author of Blue Gold and Blue Covenant and is a very well-known water activist. She's been appointed senior advisor on water to the UN General Assembly. And for the first time, it looks like we could have some movement on a treaty on the human right to water. And this is very exciting because at these forums and the policies promoted by the World Bank and the World Water Council, who host this forum, they believe that water is a need, but that it is a need that its availability is determined by the market. And we believe that water is a human right and a public good, and that we need to protect water, have good management practices, make sure that there's enough water for ecology as well for human uses. And so we can't leave it to the private corporations that are going to profit from water trading and water marketing to do the right thing. And during the World Water Forum, there are going to be many national events here in the U.S., in New York, in California, Florida, Minnesota, Maine, where people are doing local events talking about these issues and then referencing what's happening at the World Water Forum. And it's not too late for people to contact one of our organizers and get involved in one of these local events.
That was Winona Howder, director of Food and Water Watch. Contact the group at area code 202-683-2500 or visit their website at foodandwaterwatch.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Ruben Abreu, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.